This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
I don't know about you, but some of my favorite science fiction stories, from H.G. Wells to Humpback Whales to Bill and Ted, involve some form of time travel. But when I try to sit down and make sense of time travel, it always ends up making my head hurt.
That's the healthy reaction. If it doesn't make your head hurt, you're not thinking about it.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll take a look at the history of time travel and why we can't seem to get enough of that concept. Then we'll learn about special classes for police officers in San Francisco aimed at helping first responders turn tense situations into peaceful outcomes. And we'll spend an academic minute mourning the death of the mall. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Ever since H.G. Wells introduced us to his time machine, stories about time travel have been a staple for science fiction writers and fans, and it appears we just can't get enough of them. That's where James Gleick comes in. James Gleick is a best-selling science and technology author who took a look at our fascination with time travel in his new book, Time Travel, A History. We spoke about the book and asked him why this was the right time to write about time and time travel.
I have written about time before, now and again, here and there. I've been writing about science pretty much my whole career, and time enters into it now and then. And I didn't intend to write a book about time because that would be insane. It's too big and difficult a subject. But time travel seemed like a more modest thing to write about. And what made me think that there was actually a story to tell was the discovery that it's a relatively new idea, that time travel hasn't been part of the human imagination all through our history, which I did assume. It really dates back very specifically to H.G. Wells in 1895 and his first book, The Time Machine.
And really, every conversation about time travel has to start with H.G. Wells, doesn't it?
Well, it makes sense to start with him, because that's really where the idea enters our culture. And because it's an idea, and it's finite, and it has a starting point, you can watch it evolve, and you can watch a sort of global conversation take place over the generations.
And why does this concept of traveling through time fascinate us? Why do we care so much? And we really do. Because those stories, time travel stories, though they make your head hurt, to me, they're like some of the best stories told in science fiction.
Yeah, I've always felt that way, too. And I had to try and figure out why I felt that way. One reason is just the twistiness of them gives you a kind of pleasure if your mind works a certain way. But more than that, time is really important to us. It's the last great mystery. It's the last frontier. We have regrets. We wish we could go back and do something over. That's entirely, I believe, a human behavior. I mean, I love my dog, and I think my dog is a surprisingly intelligent creature, but I am quite sure that he never stops and thinks, well, if only I had done X, you know, I'd be getting a cookie now. And similarly, as humans, we have the ability to imagine ourselves in the future, to project ourselves forward in time, and to speculate about what might be and what might have been, about alternative realities. And this is imagination firing on all cylinders. And you can't start reading time travel stories and exploring its history without bumping up against the most difficult and fundamental human questions, I think.
Well, the other thing you bump up against, and you do speak about this in the book, are paradoxes. And I think this is what makes people's heads hurt the most. Well, if you go back and you do that, then paradoxes are just, they're infinite, aren't they?
Well, they're infinite, and yet there's really only one. All of the many variations are, in a way, the same paradox. And the version of it that a lot of people have heard of is the one called the grandfather paradox, where, for whatever reason, you take your time machine back far enough in time to meet your grandfather, and then you kill him I don't know why, but that's the hypothesis. And then the result of that is that you were never born. And so now, because you were never born, your grandfather is just fine, and so on. There's no getting out of this loop. Every other paradox that involves going back into the past and changing history and altering something, you know, it's a causal loop. It's retrocausality, the philosophers might say, and there's no escaping it. And many time travel stories and movies succeed by giving you the illusion that there's a solution to the problem. History was changed, but we forgot. Or the time traveler tries to change history but can't for some mysterious reason. It's all a kind of a beautiful sleight of hand.
I love the way you describe how turning the pages of a book is really time travel in its own sense.
Well, isn't it? I mean, we tell stories. We have our stories have a beginning and a middle and an end. That's what defines a story. And yet, we've got the ability to go back and forth. And sometimes we need to go back and forth. So we can have the luxury of time travel in a story if the story is right in our laps in the pages of a book.
How seriously has time travel been scientifically studied? Like, are people actually trying to figure out how to do this?
I don't think there's any point in that, to be honest with you, but that's because I'm not a scientist. I can say as a sociological matter that if you ask a bunch of science fiction writers, is time travel real? Is it worthy of scientific study? They will pretty unanimously tell you no. But if you ask a bunch of scientists, you get a much more optimistic answer, and lots of physicists will tell you we can't rule it out. Even Einstein's associate, the great logician Kurt Gödel, had a solution to Einstein's equations of relativity in which a certain kind of universe would allow time travel to the past, and he was very excited about that and very proud of that. And there are theoretical physicists today who study wormholes and whether these hypothetical cosmic creatures, if handled correctly, could enable a form of time travel. So, yeah, people think about it, but if any of our listeners are hoping to get a time machine under the Christmas tree this year, I'm going to predict disappointment.
The government is not funding the time tunnel someplace in Arizona.
Well, no, I don't think they are, although, again, there are people who will swear to you that the government has some secret time travel projects underway.
As you were going through then and writing this book, what happened? What surprised you as you were going? What did you learn that you didn't think you were going to learn?
Well, two things. One, I learned that I was writing a book about time after all, that it wasn't just about science fiction. And that was okay. I relaxed into it. But another thing I learned, I guess, is part of the story I tell is about how smart we've gotten about time, how much we've learned, what capable creatures we are. We have a lot of nice technologies that allow us to peer back into the past and project our messages into the future. And I remembered at some point that a piece of advice you often hear is live in the now. Don't worry too much about the past, which you can't control, or the future. Just enjoy the present. That's the best way to live a healthy life. And I realized I don't actually believe that. I think we can do better than living in the now. We're imaginative creatures, and we have the ability to live in the past and the future as well as the now, and we might as well enjoy all that.
Getting off this book, I've gone back and I've read some of your blog posts, and one thing, and I've always agreed with this, one thing you've written about is doing away with time zones. I think that's brilliant, and it should happen tomorrow.
Well, that's pretty controversial, and it's not going to happen tomorrow. But I also think daylight savings time has outlived its usefulness. You know, we don't really need it anymore. It was an accident of history, and it's run its course.
Again, the name of James Glick's new book is Time Travel, A History. It's published by Vintage Books. Still to come, police officers in San Francisco are taking classes to learn how to defuse a situation before it turns violent. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. When 26-year-old Mario Woods was shot to death by a San Francisco police officer in 2015, the city responded rather quickly with street protests and town hall meetings. The incident caused many to call for police reform and better training. Yet three of the five officers involved in the shooting had already attended the San Francisco PD's 40-hour crisis intervention training class. This kind of training is focused on responding to those in a mental health emergency, although it's not clear whether this was the case in the Mario Woods incident. But with the mental health care system strained and cash strapped, the burden of these emergencies is increasingly falling to police. So far, roughly 22% of the San Francisco Police Department have taken the crisis intervention training course. But can 40 hours sitting in a classroom prepare police officers for what they'll face on the streets? For the program Cross Current, Holly J. McDeed reports.
It's the last day of the San Francisco Police Department Crisis Intervention Training Class. Around 20 officers sit at attention. Some cross their arms.
Not going to be talking to you about tactics today. That's not what this class is about.
Experts present statistics about issues like suicide and post-traumatic stress. There's a history lesson on homelessness. And then there's role-playing. One student acts as the police officer, while another pretends to be a suicidal man with a knife in a public park.
Hey, what you got in your hand, sir?
Just something I found on the wheelchair.
Oh, yeah?
Don't worry, you guys.
You want to do me a favor and can you drop it, please? Let me just see your hands.
The officer earns the man's trust by speaking calmly and asking questions about his family. The man drops his knife. As the mock bystanders chant, the officer finally gets the man in the back of the police car, on one condition.
I just don't want to be bum rushed.
You know what? You don't have to worry about that. Okay? I promise you I will not bum rush you.
In the scene, the suicidal man is calm and quiet, and it doesn't take much to convince him to change his plans. Once it's over, one student raises his hand and points out that if the officer really encountered a man in the park with a weapon, things would have gone down differently. He says a so-called lethal, a gun, would probably be involved.
We're probably going to have a lethal around as well because, you know, he's got a knife. If he advances at us and we don't have our guns out or anything like that, he's going to get to us before we get to our guns and get to him.
That's the rationale that Chief Greg Sir gave in the Mario Woods shooting. Officers felt threatened, so they opened fire.
You know, doing all this, you know, soft-talking and everything like that, like I said, when we're out on the street, it's a different scenario.
It is different in here. It's controlled. And that gives officers a chance to slow down and learn different de-escalation tactics. And they also learn how to refer people to treatment services. There's not much else they can do to help solve long-term psychological problems, but there's at least one sergeant in the department whose job is to try.
So hello, I'm Kelly Kruger. I'm a sergeant with the San Francisco Police Department, and I'm the psychiatric liaison in the Special Victims Unit.
It's the psychiatric liaison unit, but it's a unit of one, just her. When officers struggle to find a way to help someone who's mentally ill, they call Kruger. It's her job to help those people find the services and get the diagnosis they need. And there's a lot of need.
So these are all phone calls and are things that I need to do stuff with, like today, ideally. It's just like, holy moly. I do wish that it could settle down a little bit.
Kruger's office is filled with hundreds of files everywhere, plus a filing cabinet of more files. She flips through sheets of paper, each one telling the story of a different person. And do you know how many cases you have?
No, it wouldn't even. It would upset. It would be too. No, I don't. Is a short answer. There's been times.
Krueger says the number of cases she's had to respond to has at least doubled since she started her job roughly a decade ago. Before that, she spent over 20 years as a psychiatric technician at hospitals and with mobile crisis units. She applied for this job because she didn't think law officers grasped what it meant to have a mental illness at the time, and she thought that she could help. Every day, she'll get about 40 phone calls.
This might be my traumatic brain injury guy, and okay. I want to tell you this story after. Hello? I had a feeling it was you. How's it going? So, I was noticing how your birthday's coming up on Sunday. So, I wanted to see if you wanted any kind of birthday thing when I visit you tomorrow.
Her days start around 11 a.m. and end at about 2 a.m. Since she is the psychiatric liaison unit, she doesn't have time to respond to every call.
Back when I worked for the Department of Public Health, we do a full assessment, be thorough. It had to be complete. You know, now I just sort of run around to the biggest fire.
So she focuses on the fires she can control, like one woman who won't let her elderly parents use the restroom in their house. The woman also vandalized some neighbors' cars. They're the ones who went to the cops, and those cops went to Krueger. We drive over to the woman's home in the Bayview district, and Krueger sits down with her on the curb for a talk. Krueger is not afraid to be direct. Minutes into their conversation, she asks,
"Have you been able to stay clean and sober yourself, as far as substances go?"
I'll be honest with you.
Yeah. I love honesty.
She confesses to Krueger that she's been smoking crystal meth as a painkiller.
I see.
I apologize.
Krueger wants to know if her parents are safe. Then she tries to see how she can help.
This is what I need to know from you, though, and I appreciate you being honest with me. If we could arrange like a better living situation for you, that you where you had your own space, would that be something that you'd be interested in?
They exchange phone numbers, and then we leave. I asked Krueger if she thinks progress was made.
She seemed more scattered on my first meeting, so I'm hoping she actually will do what she said she would do. But I feel like it was a positive experience, and you build trust by being consistent with the things that you say. You know what I mean? So certainly no harm was done.
Krueger encourages her colleagues to respond to these situations the way she does, calmly, with open ears. Her boss, San Francisco Police Chief Greg Sir, has made it a department-wide policy for officers to respond to a psychiatric crisis slowly. The crisis intervention training is designed to give them practice in doing their jobs like Krueger does hers. Sergeant Mario Molina organized the most recent class.
So by receiving the training, they are taught to slow down. To slow down, set up a perimeter. If we have to be there all day, we'll be there all day.
Molina says you can see examples of this working.
There was a gentleman that has stolen a car, went into a fire escape, and the officers cordoned off the street, went and talked to him. It took a while.
And after a few hours just talking to the man, they realized he really wanted to see his cat. So they brought the cat up to him.
But we got this guy down from this fire escape, you know, without getting harmed, right?
But Kelly Krueger acknowledges that stories like those aren't enough to show what's working and what isn't.
So it's getting the word of mouth, the feedback. But that isn't to the level of if we had people, you know, doing real research.
There haven't been any studies showing that crisis intervention training is effective in San Francisco. But there has been research elsewhere. Since 2011, SFPD has based its training on the so-called Memphis model, which was launched in that city in 1988 after police shot and killed a mentally ill man wielding a knife. The model is now in use in over 2,500 police departments nationwide. Some studies show that implementation can lead to reduction in arrests and police use of force for people with mental illnesses. But Sergeant Krueger doesn't think the success of crisis intervention training can only be measured by shootings or arrests. If an officer's life is at risk, she says, force will be necessary.
The officer is going to respond the same way regardless of whether the person is mentally ill if somebody is trying to take the life of somebody else or their lives.
During our drive, the radio blares out different emergencies throughout the city.
That's 800 critical response market near the 7-Eleven yelling and screaming, beating herself on the sidewalk.
So far, about 1 in 5 San Francisco police officers have taken the crisis intervention training course. That's a start, but it still means there's not always a trained officer available to respond to these kinds of calls. Trained or not, whoever does respond won't have the time Krueger has to develop a long relationship. They'll have a few minutes, maybe even seconds, to figure out what to do. In San Francisco, I'm Holly J. McDeed for Cross Currents.
For years, people of all ages have shopped and hung out at the mall, but that's happening a lot less these days, probably because there are a lot fewer malls. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Is the era of the shopping mall coming to a close? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Stefan Ahl, associate professor of city and regional planning at the University of Pennsylvania, determines whether the mall is really dying or just needs a shakeup.
The mall isn't dead, it's just changing. Today, thousands of empty suburban malls dot the American landscape. Describing decaying buildings and cracked asphalt parking lots, eulogy after eulogy arrives at the same conclusion. The mall is dead. But 8,000 miles away, another vision of the mall has taken hold, one that could well spell its future. Hong Kong has more than 300 shopping centers, but most of the city's malls don't sit on asphalt parking lots. Rather, they're above subway stations or underneath skyscrapers. Some are connected to so many towers that they form megastructures, cities in and of themselves that can accommodate tens of thousands of people who live, work, and play without ever going outside. Now developers in mainland China and around the world are beginning to closely copy Hong Kong's projects. But will they improve upon the suburban shopping mall's faults or simply exacerbate them? Unlike the sprawling suburban counterparts, the urban malls belong to a high-density, mixed-use community, and they're surrounded by apartments and pedestrians rather than a sea of asphalt and cars. But as convenient this urban form may be, it does come with strings attached. In the case of many of Hong Kong's developments, the mall is deliberately placed at the intersection of old pedestrian flows, between old entry points into the structure and the residential office and transit areas. They're impossible to miss and impossible to avoid. It normalizes a culture of consumerism. Everyday life is played out on the terrain of the mall, and the private shopping atrium takes on the role of the public square. The Asian hyperdense urban mall is also making an appearance in American cities. Miami has Brickell City Center, New York City has the Santiago Calatrava design Oculus in the new World Trade Center, and there are more to come. In short, the mall isn't dead, it's just changing.
That was Stefan Ahl of the University of Pennsylvania. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.